This week on the Moscow Report, it's one of the most important interviews I've done on this show. It's with the highly respected German journalist Hüseyin Doğru, who for the last couple of years has focused his work on the horrors that we've seen in Gaza and of pro-Palestine protests in Europe. For his work, the European Union some time ago decided to sanction him. It's the first case of its kind, effectively taking away some of the most basic human rights of one of their own citizens due to their journalistic work. Interestingly, the apparatus they've used to take away his rights are the anti-Russia sanctions, even though there's no evidence that he has any links to Russia. He has had some support from important European luminaries like the MEP Claire Daly and the former Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis, who see his case as fundamental to the future of human rights and free expression in Europe. And I do believe that it is important for journalists inside and outside the mainstream to stand up for his case and not let it to stand. Hüseyin, thank you so much for joining me. Now, first of all, what is your situation? You've been sanctioned by the European Union. Your bank account's been frozen. There's a travel ban. What is that like, first of all? How has it impinged on your rights and your ability to work and live?
So first, thank you for having me here and giving me the opportunity to talk about my case. Being sanctioned as a European citizen within Europe is being in a open prison. You're stripped of all your rights. You're not allowed to work. You're not allowed to earn any income to support your family. You're not allowed to leave the country which you live in or even freely move as a European citizen within Europe. And I think the most hard or more extreme part of it is that my family is suffering from that, even though they have nothing to do with that, because the situation which I'm in, financial situation, but also legal situation, affects them as well. Right now, the situation with me is that nobody can assess, not even the German government, which is responsible for executing the sanctions on me, because I'm in Germany. Even they don't know what the legal status of me is, because sanctions are designed for foreign people living not in Europe, but I'm living in Europe, so it is a black hole right now for all of us, for my family, for me, and for my children.
To sum up your case, first of all, I mean, you're a German journalist, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the last couple of years you've mainly been focused on the horrors that we've seen in Gaza and covering protests in Germany against what is happening in Gaza. But you seem to have been sanctioned under anti-Russia sanctions. That seems very strange. Explain that.
To be able to understand that, I think we need to remember that Germany is not theoretically, but practically in a war. State of mind is in a war situation and actively supporting a war in the Middle East, which is the genocide against Palestinians. So if a country is in a war, it is fighting a designated enemy outside of its country, but also inside of its country itself, which is its own population, which are the critical journalists, which are people like me, who are highlighting the crimes that our government here commits. By violating international law, by supporting a genocide, supporting politicians who have international arrest warrants. And if you do so, then that's government, which is fighting effectively two front wars, is trying to suppress every single critical voice within its own borders to shut down any opposition. And to be able to do that, they labeled me as a Russian disinformation secret operative here in Germany, because their legal argumentation is, by highlighting the situation of Palestinians in Gaza who are suffering a genocide, by interviewing Palestinian resistance factions like Hamas, like PFLP, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, I would contribute to the disinformation campaign of Russia.
I saw Claire Daly, the famous Irish MEP, talking about your case in Parliament, and as she said, it seems that pro-Palestinian activism in Europe is seen, as you say, as a Russian destabilization campaign. I mean, I think it's more likely the horrors of the slaughter of children that the Europeans are seeing on their TV screens is why Europeans are taking to the streets. But they seem to suggest with your case that it's somehow Russian destabilization.
That goes far back about what happened within Europe since 2012-2015, when the whole conflict around in and outside of Ukraine happened. The European Union put some laws into place which enabled the German government to do all of these things. What they technically did is the European Union militarized information, militarized journalism, which are not aligned with their core narratives, which they openly say so. Maybe you heard of the DSA Act, Digital Service Act of the European Union, which started around 2018, which said disinformation is undermining the European project, questioning the democratic legitimacy. And by saying so, they started to target journalists here, which are not or questioning the politics of the European Union. And that turned into like a repression machine here in Europe, which is used especially since 2015-16 with the Russia label. Because as you know as well from your journalism, governments push illegal or authoritarian laws when there is a kind of fear within the society. And German society, or European society, is in a fear created by the European Union that Russia is going to attack us, or Hamas operatives are within European borders will do terrorist attacks. And these,
because what is your, can I just ask you, what is your views on Russia? I saw an article you wrote recently in which you referred to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which isn't the words that the Russian government or Russian media would use about what is happening in Ukraine. I know you're critical of the militarism that's happening in NATO, but you don't seem to have been campaigning very much, too much. You've been focused on other issues. You don't seem to be pushing Russian disinformation very much.
No, I mean, my view on Russia, which I expressed on several occasions and also in my work as well, is I see Russia like I do see European countries, as well as two sides of imperialist blocs who are fighting for political capital interests right now in Ukraine. That was always my view. This is always what I critiqued.
And so you've been sanctioned for essentially under this Russian sanction regime, but have they given you any evidence that you are linked to Russia?
If you look at the sanction paper, which is public, it says, as you also mentioned at the beginning, sanctioned in context of the 17 Russia sanctions. Then the explanation in that paper is by news coverage on primarily pro-Palestinian protests, the crackdown on pro-Palestinian protests here, covering a university occupation, which was for them apparently dangerous to cover that, and covering violent protests within the European Union. That was categorized as creating discord and destabilizing or threatening the unity of the European Union. But later, we got the evidence pack of the European Union, which was something completely else, which is critical opinions, my private opinions, but also as Red Media, my media outlet back then, about the German politics, about historical facts that we publish. One example, and this is a historical fact, that former SS Nazis, SS commanders, SA commanders from Hitler fascism after the Second World War became commanders or generals within NATO and had very high ranking positions. The European Union categorized that as wrong and disinformation, or a critique of me that German journalists do not cover the repression against me was categorized as disinformation and used to sanction me as well. So it's two different layers, three different, is accusing of being Russian, explaining with Palestine, but the evidence indicates that the German government was not happy about my reporting and critique with their politics.
And so they've just tried to find, in intelligence speak, it's called throwing spaghetti at a wall. It seems that they're, see whatever sticks. It seems that they're just trying to push anything on you, but without any real evidence.
No, there is no real evidence. Technically, what they present as evidence is disinformation itself and historical revisionism. I think it was McNamara, the European MEP, who said, by fighting disinformation, we are becoming exactly what we are fighting against. And this is today happening. And I think Europe is not doing a mistake, is not a glitch in the matrix, or it is not a stupidity of certain political, I think it's a political line today, that information needs to be controlled, critical voices need to be shut down, oppressed, even if it's journalists now today. Step by step, the liberal bourgeois democracy that we know needs to be dismantled by those who are upholding that, because today it is a barrier, it is an obstacle for them to push their militaristic agenda, their Rearm Europe project, and the entire shift to the right within Europe as well. And the only barrier for that is their liberal democracy, and now it needs to step by step demolished. This is what is happening in Europe.
So I want to ask you something very important, perhaps the most important question today. I've seen you actually sent me a document by a former European court judge. It's a recent document in which basically they make clear that the sanctions regime, particularly against you, because you're a German citizen, you're not Russian, is actually against European law. Now, I've read the document, it's all in legal speak, but it makes clear basically what anybody, even without a legal background, should intuitively be able to understand, that taking away a citizen's rights without any due process is quite clearly not only against European law, but against the founding basis of European civilization.
Yes, the report mentions several elements here. First is that the European Union, by sanctioning a European citizen, stripped off all of his rights, which he or she has within the European Union, which is freedom of movement, freedom of expression, and the right to technically survive, to be able to work. So these rights are stripped off. I'm not allowed to exist. Just to make it maybe more concrete, people think about sanctions, assets are frozen, as I would have like millions now in my account, then I would definitely not be here. And you're not allowed to travel, but it goes further technically. So what is happening with me specifically is that the right of existence is gone. The right as a European citizen is gone, as Yanis Varoufakis mentioned as well. You're non-person anymore. And I think that is the punishment itself. And if you go also further and read in this report, it also says, and therefore, for that you need to understand sanctions. Sanctions, like the European Union describes it, about to bring a change in your behavior. And later they say it is not about non-illegal behavior. It is about non-illegal illegal behavior that we want to change. So you don't need to do anything wrong.
So if you think, if you suddenly gave up your work, if you announced on X or whatever, you know, your social platforms, that I am giving up my work, my journalistic work, do you think they'd just take the sanctions off? I think they would.
I don't think they would. Like, first of all, I would not do it because I did nothing wrong. I used my rights, which they are supposed to uphold, first of all. Second, I do not think they will reverse the sanctions, because the sanctions itself is illegal, because there is no disinformation, there is no wrong information, there is no support for the Russian government at its war in Ukraine, or whatsoever. I mean, the legal report highlights that as well, that The problem is not the person, the problem is the mechanism that the European Union created, that now a certain intent, a certain different opinion can be now punished without judicial control. That's also what they critique. It is an extrajudicial process.
Because if your case is allowed to stand, if what's happening to you is allowed to stand, essentially now the European Union can strip citizens of their rights for essentially putting across ideas that they don't like. In fact, on any subject, I mean, you've hardly even spoken about Ukraine. You've, like millions of European people, you've been angry and through your journalism advocating, if you like, for Palestinians or right to protest over Palestinians, and that's essentially why you've been sanctioned. So if your case is allowed to stand, it essentially means the European Union can strip anybody of their rights without any due process.
Exactly, like my case right now is a precedent case. If, as my lawyer said, you're holding the Pandora's box closed, and if you leave that now, that Pandora's box is opened, and it's doomsday in Europe. And we can feel that this fear is working in Germany, because there is an extreme self-censorship of journalists, of politicians and activists. They're not talking about it. Personally, they talk with me. It's so horrible with you what happened, but it's too hot for me.
Because
and this is the aim. The process itself is the aim.
And is that one of the reasons they went after? Because I have the same experience as you. You know, obviously, the last few years I've been known for my criticism over NATO policy of Ukraine, but I speak to mainstream journalists privately. They say very different things than they do publicly. But is that one of the reasons you think they've gone for you? Because if you silence one journalist, if you kill one journalist, you silence hundreds or thousands more. And is that? Do you think what's happened to you has had a chilling effect on German journalism?
Yeah, what happened to me has a chilling, has a extreme dangerous effect, not on the journalists, but on the entire society and the political spectrum as well. It is something that is legalized by the European Union that gives all the possibilities to do that. So the governments itself can execute all of that by referring to the European Union. A, impunity, like the German government says, we did not do that, it's the European Union. And therefore it becomes like legitimized for them. And they will, they're extending these more repressions more and more. And that has a chilling effect. That has an effect of fear. That has an effect of what the liberal journalists describe happening in Iran, happening in China, happening in Venezuela, these authoritarian regimes. But this is even far worse here. For example, I'm someone with a Kurdish background. I know all the political experiences and the repression in Turkey as well. In Turkey, they do it, the repression, without having a legal ground. Here in Europe, which is more dangerous, they have a legal ground now. They can refer to the rights, to the regulations of the European Union, and to emergency situations that they create themselves, and have a legal base for it. And this is, I think, the most dangerous, and it will attack in the future. Working class people who want to strike, journalists who want to write, musicians who want to perform arts, which the government does not like anymore.
And so there are increasingly other cases in Germany, the UK, Europe. I don't know whether you know that George Galloway, I'm sure you know who he is, very recently has gone into exile because he was detained as he got off a plane in London. There are other cases, my own case. do you feel, and these seem to be, it's difficult to know whether criticizing Israel or criticizing NATO policies on Ukraine is worse. But do you fear that with your journalistic colleagues and around Europe that there is increasing authoritarianism and a fear of extreme repercussions for speaking out?
Yes, we can feel that everywhere. If you, as a journalist, have no trade union backing you up, in contrary, being part of that repression, if you have mainstream journalists who are becoming now the mouthpiece of the governments here by starting disinformation campaigns. I mean, we saw the best example, it was with me here in Germany. My sanctions are technically a result of the disinformation campaign of mainstream journalists here. Or we saw it when Jeremy Corbyn a couple of years was attacked by mainstream media for being anti-Semitic. We saw the whole atmosphere created by the 10% of media outlets that we are in a, there is an imminent threat for us, that Russia or someone else will attack us. That creates that authoritarianism. This is part of the authoritarianism, because governments use media to enforce or control information. And that's the dangerous side. Like, the information that I gave is not wrong. Like, the best example, I interviewed Hamas representatives. That was categorized by the European Union and today by the German government as giving terrorist organizations a platform. The very same Hamas politician was interviewed by German mainstream media. That was okay. So that shows me it is not about if the information is right or wrong. It's about having the monopoly on information to influence the society. This is what they're afraid of, especially when you have journalists like you or journalists like in England that we saw from Electronic Intifada, SO Incident, I think it was, whose house was raided. And across the board, Richard Matthurst, for example, is about if you have these little cases of journalists which you can't control, then you need to suppress them with all the means necessary. And it is, in the past, it was only the police, military, or the government itself, but they have now found a better tool, which is their own, which I call now state-funded independent journalists, or the foot soldiers of their politics today.
Because it seems crazy, that this is one of my major points, that suppressing these journalists, and I know most of the people you've just mentioned, I'm sure you do as well, that there's some outstanding journalists out there who are all too often just correct in their work. Those who criticized Israel at the start of what happened in Gaza suddenly become more mainstream. The realization that what Israel is doing actually is not also not in Western interests. And indeed, for example, my work on Ukraine, I warned the West or NATO that they would fail in Ukraine, the counteroffensive would be a failure. And now you say that there should be peace. That is changing. It seems that closing down journalists have they perform a civil duty. The idea that that Germany shouldn't be blindly supporting Israel, the idea that Germany or the European Union should not be blindly supporting Ukraine, it's very easy to make that case that it's in European interests not to do these things. And it's journalists like yourself who are stating that. So to silence them and shut them down, in my view, is simply not in German or European interests. It's damaging European interests by silencing someone like you.
I agree. I think it is not about European interests anymore. It's about the interests of certain capitalist interests. It's about the interests of certain military-industrial complex. It's for lobby organizations. If you look today, especially Germany praises up never again, never again, never again. If they mean never again, it means also for the most oppressed people right now in Germany, which are the Muslims, which are the migrants, which are people of color, which are Palestinians especially. I think this rhetoric, never again, upholding democracy, is used to push certain political interests. I don't believe that Germany, for example, is supporting Israel because of the historical guilt. That is non-existent today, because before October 7, there was a sharp rise of anti-Semitic attacks by the far right here, but we don't talk about that. I think Gaza is a good, or October 7, the prison break of October 7, was a good opportunity to push their interest, to regain interest again in the Middle East, which they lost. I mean, pre-October 7, the influence of the West in the Middle East was almost non-existent, except the US. Now they have the opportunity to go in, now they have to push, or they can push certain political and military interests as well. I mean, we know that the whole thing that happened in Syria, it was not about Assad or not Assad. We know that the attacks on Iran is not about to bring back democracy in Iran. It's about step by step opening up the way towards China as well, to the bigger threat, economical, political, cultural threat. I think these are little elements that they use today to go for a long strategic political militaristic plan. And that you can see being reflected in the European politics. Rearm Europe. Germany wants to spend $500 billion into military. Everyone needs to spend more for militarization. But those who talk about unemployment here, about housing, about economical crisis. They're being shut down. And these journalists, it's been you, it's been me, and it's been others as well. So we should not talk about the misery that this system here created, but we should look at the supposed threats that come from Asia and Middle East. It's a distraction for me. Yes, we have problems around the world, obviously, but we need to start here. We need to start fix things in these countries before we bomb other countries like it is a European tradition to do so.
And so what do you plan to do now? I mean, I know you've had some quite important support from some European MEPs, Yanis Varoufakis, the famous former German economy minister. You have got some...
Greek economic minister.
Greek, what did I say? German, I'm so sorry. Greek economist, economic minister. So you do have, I mean, you're a very respected journalist. You do have some support. But what do you plan to do now? I mean, is it difficult living now? You're carrying on your work as you can. But what do you plan to do? Do you want to take this to court? How are you going forward in this?
Right now, we submitted our case to the European Court of Justice, which will now review our case and then decide at some point if there will be a hearing or not. Sometimes the European Court of Justice decides without a hearing, yet it was wrong or right, etc., etc. But before submitting our case to the European Court of Justice, we asked, because that's the process, you need to ask the European Commission to rethink the sanctions 3 times, and they said no, it's legit. We did no mistakes. As the German Foreign Ministry spokesperson said, Germany does no mistakes. They literally responded to the journalist's question about me. Said no, we don't do mistakes. So we are waiting. That can take 2 weeks, 2 months, 2 years, 4 years. We don't know. But there is a danger in that, as the former European Court of Justice judge wrote in her report. Every 6 months, sanctions are reviewed. It sounds very good, but it's a danger because, again, there is a mechanism there. Every 6 months, they could sanction you again for another reason. While I'm fighting that, then another case opens up. So I could be in a limbo for years and years, maybe a decade. We don't know.
Especially as you're carrying on your work. So you don't know, you could say something or do something, they decide, well, we don't like that either.
Exactly. Like, just me complaining about that, that my case is not covered in the media, was a reason to keep my sanctions. That was officially used as a reason, because that was disinformation for them. I'm still working, but I think all the newspapers who are in solidarity with me, they're kind of happy because they don't have to pay me, because they can't pay me right now, it's forbidden. You can be charged up to 5 years, I think, for that, going to prison. But I need to work because it is important, especially during times when the oppression is the highest, to inform people about that so it does not happen again. And this is my understanding, never again is now, by standing up against that.
Because I think your case really is a deeply important case for the future of Europe. If it's allowed to carry on what's happening to you, then it will happen to other people. Do you fear for the future of freedom of speech in Europe?
I think the future is already now. I do fear. It is dangerous. It is very... It reminds a little bit of the dark times in Europe in the 30s. It reminds... And there are parallels to that. I don't say it's the same, obviously not, but parallels do happen. I think it was before Hitler took power, or short after that. Don't nail me on the ear, like 36, 7, 38. There was a law brought up by the Nazis called Schriftleitergesetz, which meant that newspapers or the editors-in-chief needed to report benefit, like in how do you say that, in line with the governmental interests. Otherwise, they could be arrested, prosecuted, or killed. Today, they don't kill you, literally, but the EU says. And that's the whole definition of sanctions as well, which is quite creepy. sanctions are designed to change your legal behavior with a view to promoting the objectives of the European Union and its foreign security policy. Like, it is the same. If you want to be very...
What shocks me about this is that European policy, foreign policy, is clearly doing huge damage to the European, to European states and the European people. If you look at their policy on Russia and Ukraine, even if the most pro-Ukrainian supporter would admit that European policy has been a disaster, it's caused huge damage to European industries. And so now you've got to this cycle, this damaging cycle, where you can't criticize European policy, even though European policy is wrong and it's damaging European interests.
I think it is a designed cycle. Again, I will do historical comparisons here. What is happening today, because you mentioned a couple of times that what is happening today, or what European Union does today, is technically damaging the European economy, the European society, and you're right. And that happened also before Hitler took power back then. And Europe was, or Germany was, in an economical crisis. Its car industry, its industry, manufacturers, it was all in a crisis. And then Hitler came, took power, or they gave him the power, and he changed the whole industry into a militaristic industry. And this is what we're seeing today. We see, I mean, if you look at the statistics of the German government and the news about, from the last 2 years, the car industry, which was the heart of Germany, is collapsing. It is compared to others around the world. And now they need to change that industry into something that is bringing you profits. And what brings you more profits than war? Because if you're on an active war, you need to buy weapons. Look at Germany's Rheinmetall. It was, their stock price were before the war in Ukraine on the bottom. Now it's skyrocketed. You can't even buy, I don't know if you are into stocks, but you can't even buy that now. They're billionaires, trillionaires today. And if you look who's benefiting from that crisis, I think things get very obvious. It's not the people in Europe. It's not the people in Russia, China, or whatsoever. It is these companies. It is these military industrial complexes that benefit from it. That's why they want and need the war.
About you. IRIB English Radio.
Good night to all of our listeners. You're tuned in Iran Radio, broadcast from Tehran. So nice to have you in this moment. We start off this hour's programs with To My Brother. The program examines the universal principles contained in the teachings of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, and their importance for contemporary individuals and societies. Next up will be our radio productions feature, and we round up this hour's programs with Let's Recite the Quran. The program teaches eloquent recitation of the Holy Quran at level 2. Stay with us for this hour.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
السلام عليك يا أمين الله في
أرض. Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. This is To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. It's great to have all of you here, and today we want to talk about a character who not only influenced Muslims across the world, but influenced many non-Muslims as well. This great personality is the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace and blessings upon him. And as history is a testament, and furthermore both friend and enemy have testified openly, Imam Ali alayhi salam was not tainted with any vices, unlike so many others who surrounded him and opposed him. He had a perfect faith in Allah, and so he acted according to his belief. Imam Ali alayhi salam was a lantern of guidance in his time, where the sunnah of the Holy Prophet had begun to be forgotten. Yet Imam Ali remained steadfast on the path of the pure Muhammadan Islam, like a solid, unshakable fortress in the middle of a great wild storm.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام ما كذبت ولا كذبت ولا ضللت ولا ضل بي.
Ali alayhi salam said, I have neither spoken a lie, nor have I been told a lie. I have neither deviated, nor have I been made to deviate others.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is To My Brother, and we're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So, dear friends, humbly at your service, speaking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, alhamdulillah. It is such a beautiful persona to be speaking about indeed. We find that one of the very beautiful aspects of the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, something that, you know, every single human being can in one way or the other really benefit from and really move forward and have progress and development in their life, is this faith that Imam Ali alayhi salam had, and more specifically, the faith that Imam Ali alayhi salam had in the Almighty Allah. We find that Imam Ali alayhi salam, he at one time said that even if the covering, meaning the veils of the facts of faith, are uncovered for me, this will by no means increase my current conviction. So just to repeat that, he says that even if the coverings of the veils are uncovered for me, this will by no means increase my current conviction. So, meaning that the conviction and the faith and the iman and the belief of Imam Ali alayhi salam was to a certain extent that if all of these veils of doubt and are removed from his face or from his eyes, that he is at such a high level that his conviction wouldn't increase. It's a very powerful statement. I mean, you know, the more you think about it, it means that he is at the peak of conviction. He has the peak of yaqeen. He is at the peak of his faith in the Almighty Allah, to the point where he says that, listen, if these veils of the material realm were to be removed from my eyes, and that he sees the ultimate reality the way that it is. Really, I think the more I try to explain it, the more difficult it becomes to explain, because it's such a profound statement. But this amount of faith is what really motivates an individual, and it gives support to an individual, and it fuels an individual to be able to do the great things that they do, or the great things that they can do, right? If you want to achieve something great and something amazing, you have to have some kind of a support structure behind that. You need a motivator. You need something to fuel you, that spark to get you moving and get you going and get you running. And this is what that primary and that fundamental motivator is that faith in the Almighty Allah. The stronger our faith in Allah, our belief in Allah, our trust in Allah, our love in Allah, you know, the more we're going to be able to do out of life, and the more we can do life. It is really in the trials and tribulations and difficulties and calamities and tragedies that every single one of us face in our life. If we have that faith in the Almighty Allah, only and only then will we be able to surpass and pass and come out victorious from these trials and tribulations of life. A very thought-provoking lesson indeed, brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib this means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الله سبحانه وتعالى in chapter 3 of the Quran in verse number 33 makes an announcement where he says إن الله اصطفى verily God has chosen Adam and then Nuh and then the family of Abraham and then Imran على العالمين over the rest of the people in the world. When you look at this verse of the Quran, you come to realize that all human beings have been created by Almighty God, but they are not equal in the eyes of God. As far as their status is concerned, you know, when it comes to the prophets of God, the messengers of God, those who represent Him in conveying His message, they are at a higher, you know, status than other human beings. I would like to take this opportunity to actually talk about the special status that God has given to Ahlul Bayt, the family of the Prophet. Let me, you know, just read to you two out of so many narrations, authentic ones that we have from the books of the Sunni Muslims. One is from Abdullah ibn Abbas, when somebody asked him, can you say something about Ali to us? So it seems this is the days, later days when Ali was no more alive.
And so Abdullah ibn Abbas says, let me narrate to you a saying of the Prophet. Inna Rasulullah amara bil abwab ash-shari'a fil masjid fasuddat. He says, one day the Prophet gave the command that all the doors opening inside the mosque, fasuddat, it should be, he ordered it to be closed. Illa babu Ali, except the door of Ali. فَإِنَّهُمْ وَجَدُوا مِنْ ذَٰلِكَ. Others who were told to close their doors, they felt a little bit bad about it. And so when the Prophet heard about all these complaints, he actually gathered them in the mosque. And he gave a speech there. Different narrations gave, you know, different parts of it. But it must have been a very brief speech. This is the basically the main part of it, where he says, he's now addressing the Muslims. He says, بَلَغَنِي أَنَّكُمْ وَجَدْتُمْ مِنْ صَدِّ أَبْوَابِكُمْ وَفَتْحِ بَابِ عَلِيٍ. He says, I've been told that some of you feel bad that I have closed your doors opening inside the mosque and I have allowed the door of Ali to be open. وَإِنِّي وَاللَّهِ مَا سَدَدْتُهُ مِنْ قَبْلِ نَفْسِي. The Prophet says to them that by God, I have not closed any door by my own will. Inna ala abdun ma'mur. I am the servant of God. I was told to convey the message and I conveyed the message. Umirtu bi shay'in fafaltu. I was commanded to do something and I did it. In at-tabi'i illa ma yuha ilayya. The Prophet says, I don't do anything but what is inspired and revealed to me by Almighty God.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, To My Brother. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
travel to a historical city, the goal is not just to visit museums and beautiful monuments, but you want to mix with the locals and learn about their traditions and culture. In recent years, many historical houses in Iran have turned to accommodation places, which are called Bumgardi. These are neither hotels nor hostels. They are local traditional houses that provide the opportunity for their guests to meet with locals and live like locals, even for a short time. Nartiti is the first house we visited, a beautiful place in the small town of Taft, with several traditional elements. An Iranian Zoroastrian couple owns the house. Traveling also means doing activities that we would not have done elsewhere. Each night, all the travelers who stay in this cozy place meet with the owners of the house, drink tea, and eat freshly picked pomegranate from the backyard. And so, they can experience a little different trip and realize that we all share the same fundamental values and same objectives. We're all part of the same planet, and this makes us stay connected.
Staying at these kinds of places adds to one's understanding of the world and understanding of people. It is something which gives you an understanding that all of us are the same. We're all people. We're much more similar than we are different. And when you start taking governments and other things out of the situation, it's just, we can enjoy being with each other and understanding each other and learning about each other.
Another differentiating element of the house is a wall full of memories of those who stayed a while in this place. A very interesting wall that takes you to a journey around the world.
Une nuit dans cette maison est particulièrement c'est une expérience particulièrement enrichissante puisque ça permet de partager ces expériences entre les différents voyageurs qui se croisent ici.
In Iran, when a guest or loved one leaves our house, we accompany him or her to the door and throw water to show we want him or her to return very soon. With this compassion, we left that beautiful place to discover other local guest houses. Second place is the House of Baran, which means rain in Farsi, a beautiful adobe house that truly represents the city of Yazd. A very simple house, but artistically decorated and perfectly designed with traditional Persian elements that constantly reminds you of the peaceful spirit of Iranians. A beautiful house with very positive energy. There's a logic behind the location of every piece in decorating this guest house. Some of these elements are symbolic, and some others are still functional.
The house has lots of interesting features for me as a visitor. So Abbas, the owner of this guest house, had to adjust the stairs and make them more comfortable for us, people of modern age, to be able to walk down. Because apparently, back in the old days, they were building these stairs very high. The underground room, and there is about 15 to 20 degrees Celsius temperature difference comparing it to upstairs. So making it a perfect room to chill and maybe take a nap during the hot days of summer. Also during the cold days of winter, this is gonna be a very warm room and area of the building. Few steps down and tiny little room even gets cooler. Ideal, perfect place to keep your fruits and vegetables during the hot days of summer. Natural cooling system. You know why? Because it's connected to the wind tower room.
There is always a time to say goodbye to even the most beautiful things in this world. What you take from that location or moment is usually what you see or experience towards the end. An unforgettable taste with a beautiful color. Very exciting recipe create an experience
that I will take with me from Boron Guest House. The exciting thing about all these traditional guest houses is the fact that they're all different in some ways. One is famous for its traditional elements. One is known for its design and decorations. And the other has some very moving stories about the people who lived there, the people who run it now, their families and their relatives. Local people of different regions of Iran, full of love and passion, the most